Sorry for that. Last time the microphone didn't work. This time the computer. I guess it's just my talk. My name is Kai Lutzek, and I'm going to talk about the role of phenotypic plasticity and heritability in the early stage of ecological divergence using free-spine sticklebacks from Switzerland. And does this work? To shortly outline this, I will start with a short introduction about the interaction of heritability and plasticity during ecological niche shift, followed by a short description of the model system, which is the free-spine stickleback, so the small fish that probably almost everybody in here knows, followed by the experiment, which was a full CYP reciprocal transplant type experiment in our case, where we measure population-based growth rates, geometric morphometrics, and feeding morphology, each followed by a short discussion. Let's see if it works. As an empirical biologist, especially when you work on evolutionary young systems such as invasive species or post-glacial recolonizations, you usually ask yourself how important is actually phenotypic plasticity in the contemporary niche shifts. And although many examples are described, especially among invasive species, experimental approaches to disentangle both plastic and genetic components are actually quite scarce, especially for animals. And if you think about it, if a species gets introduced in your habitat, it's likely to experience ecological stress factors such as different habitats with different food regimes and to which a species needs to adapt. And if adaptation depends mainly on mutations, mainly sentient variation, it needs mutations to arrive, which is usually a very slow process and referred to as the so-called lag phase in invasive species. However, once the genetic variation is there that it needs, it can undergo very fast range or niche expansion, say to the pelagic or littoral zones of a lake, which then leads to adaptive evolution. On the other hand, a species could use phenotypic plasticity to express readily adapted phenotypes and bypass the lag phase and undergo a range or niche expansion very fast. And over time, through, say, genetic assimilation, this could lead as well to adaptive evolution. So sticklebacks in Switzerland are actually kind of unique because unlike most other systems, they're invasive. They got introduced probably 140 years ago, seeded by different genetic lineages coming from different regions from across Europe. They subsequently colonized different habitats, including lakes and streams, and they qualitatively form similar ecotypes as in their native range. And populations differ in various rates, including color, body shape, armor, and life history. So for our experiment, we focused on one parapatric lake stream system that got introduced 140 years ago, seeded by one lineage coming from Eastern Europe, and populations differ in various traits, including body shape, as you can see here, where for a wild-caught adults and juveniles, where lake-dwelling fish are more streamlined than stream-dwelling ones, they have larger eyes and a distinct head shape, which is linked to functional morphology. And indeed, lake fish feed predominantly on plankton, whereas stream fish feed mainly on bentos. So the question that we had is, is this rapid ecological diversification that we observe actually driven by phenotypic plasticity, or do we observe already genetically determined differentiation after just 140 generations? And to answer that, we used the full CYP reciprocal transplant type experiment to disentangle both factors. We used morphometrics on skeletal structure and morphological traits that are either under ecological divergence selection or relate to functional morphology, at least according to the literature. And in addition, we estimated the relative growth rates as a proxy for fitness. And we had four different predictions for each trait, which could be, a trait could be show no differentiation at all, So there's no differentiation between source population and treatment. A trait could be mainly driven by plasticity, where treatments would differ, but not source population. It could be mainly driven by heritability, where source populations would differ, but not treatments. Or we could think about an interaction where there's the differentiation for both source and treatments. So the experiment in the end looked like this. We crossed lake fish with lake fish, stream fish with stream fish, and created F1 full zip families, which we fed for the first 5 weeks of their life on a common food resource. And after that, we selected randomly 40 individuals and split the families up to different treatments, which was either a plankton treatment fed on zooplankton, a benthos treatment fed on charonomid larvae, and we did that for 18 weeks. And to estimate population growth rates, we took pictures of all fish per tank every 2 weeks. And what we find is that lake fish significantly grow faster in the plankton treatment than stream fish, whereas there's no statistical difference in the benthos treatment. So this gives us already some evidence for genetically determined ecotypic diversification after just 140 years. And the fact that lake fish perform as well in the benthic treatment could indicate that they have a higher intrinsic growth rate in general. After the experiment, we took all the fish, we killed them, and we stained them in order to see the skeletal structure. And we used geometric morphometrics to capture the shape difference. And if you don't know what geometric morphometrics are, this is basically you take a picture of each fish and you put distinct landmarks, so the blue dots here, linked to distinct phenotypes or traits for each fish, and then you calculate the shape difference among them. And we did that using a canonical variate analysis, using treatment and source population as factor, and what we find is that on CV1, there's a significant differentiation between source populations, where traits explain most of the variation, actually all, like, with one exception, lying on the head. And lake fish here have a terminal mouth and larger eyes compared to stream fish. CV2, on the other hand, separates significantly the treatments. And we see that the traits explaining the variation actually shifting from the head to the body. And with only two exceptions here, they're all along the y-axis. And indeed, benthos-fed fish have deeper bodies and resemble the wild phenotypes. So we can now compare the two axes by plotting the relative trait loadings against each other. And we can further plot a grid line on this. And we would suspect that traits under heritability would be in this quadrant here, traits that show plasticity would be over here, and an interaction would be over there. And what we find is that trophic morphology on the head, so the blue arrows here, are mainly heritable. Body and head depth, on the other hand, so the red arrows, are mainly plastic. And we only find two landmarks showing an interaction, and they're both linked to eye size. So taken together, head shapes are similar between experimental and wild-caught individuals from the same source population. As we can see here, especially for a mouth shape, for a lake fish, where it's very similar for wild-caught owls and juveniles, and as well the shape difference among the CV1 axis, which indicates that trophic morphology seems to be heritable and is likely a result of adaptation. On the other hand, body depth varies according to treatment and matches the wild phenotypes. So, like, stream fish here are always more deep-bodied than lake fish, which is true as well for fish from the benthos treatment compared to the plankton treatment. And this trait is usually linked to swimming behavior, or thought to be linked to swimming behavior. And if you think about it, a fish fed on plankton is more likely to spend more time swimming around in order to capture small planktonic prey, and therefore is likely to reduce body depth. We measured as well some linear traits for which we only find gape width, showing a direct genetic anterior interaction effect. On the other hand, gill rakers, so the structures that fish actually need to filter small planktonic prey, we find no statistical differentiation among those traits, which was actually kind of surprising because the wild populations differ for them. So given that, we find weak or absent differentiation for linear morphology, and given that gape width shows a genetic component with some plasticity, this could be a case for a trait that could allow adaptation despite genetic constraints. Gill raker length, on the other hand, being different in the wild fish, might become more important at a later life stage, and we were just not able to capture it because we killed the fish too early. So, to conclude, we find that both plastic and genetic components may play a role in ecological diversification, and in our case, this combination led to an increase in functional ecological diversity. And even after a few evolutionary generations, we find indications for heritable diversification as indicated by growth rates and shape of the feeding apparatus, which is linked to feeding ecology. And this heritable divergence could be a first step towards ecological speciation. Furthermore, our results suggest that potentially adaptive diversification might be not so uncommon for invasive species, which is usually quite overlooked. And if you think now, so what does this actually matter if sticklebacks or species in general diverge, or does it actually affect the ecosystem? We're actually going to have, hopefully, this question's answered by one talk by Blake Matthews, and there's, I want to advertise this, one poster by one of our master students sitting in the audience, but he lost his poster, so I talked to him. With that, I would like to thank some people on the left-hand side, and especially my PhD program that actually gave me a travel grant to be here, and of course you for your attention.
We actually do have a couple of minutes for questions. So, please.
That was just simple. I wasn't clear. Were the treatments only a difference in diet, or did you actually have to be like in the environment?
No, it happened in the lab, in plants.
So it was diet. And yet they still showed plasticity and body shape.
Yes. Yeah.
Jim? Yeah. Do you think the ecotypes within lakes in Canada might be due to this kind of differentiation between streams and lakes? It's just something I'd never heard of, but I mean, surely there are streams in Canada where you find this kind of thing.
I mean, for the sympatric species within lakes in Canada, there's this second invasion scenario. So,
well, there's a scenario, but I'm asking, could it be, you know, a different scenario?
Good question. I actually don't know if they.
So when one species goes extinct in Canada, is it the limnetic or the benthic one?
Actually, they hybridize, so we have to.
Yeah. But there's usually one species or two species, right, in each lake. Can you remember which one it is?
I think it's a limnetic, but it's correct.
I think they kind of fuse into an intermediate form.
Oh, right. Okay.
But with the lake and stream fish that have been studied in other places like Canada, there are, in British Columbia, there are big genetically determined differences in body shape in these populations. But they're old, they're thousands of generations old. So do you think that if you combine your results with those results, it's suggestive of the fact that you will have genetic assimilation that eventually occurs in your populations, and will eventually body shape become genetically determined?
It could be. It's a data comparison would assume that they have a similar adaptive landscape to compare. And if that would be true, yes.